It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
I said it before and I'll say it again. Most of the Democrats on red alert regarding Doge are falling apart at the seams, not because they believe they can make a case against wasteful spending, but because of something nefarious they are trying to cover up. Probably many things, some beyond our imagination. Who knows what's going on? But I'm convinced that at least one of them is the plot to steal the 2020 election. Yes, I said it. I still stand by it. Somebody had to pay poll workers to cheat. Somebody had to pay for the production of fake ballots, or perhaps pay off judges to not hear the lawsuits. And there are probably 100 other ways shadow cash could have been disseminated. Sound strange? Sound like a wild conspiracy theory? My friends, they lied about the border being secure. They lied about Hunter's laptop and got 51 former intelligence agents to lie. They lied about Biden's mental ability. They lied about Russian collusion and invented the dossier. Why wouldn't they lie about an election? They tried to put Trump in prison. They tried to take him off the ballot. They refused to vote for a bill saying only citizens can vote in our elections. Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they cheat in the election if they did all these things? And all of this, I remind you, was done in the name of saving democracy. So while we're on the subject of democracy, Vice President J.D. Vance raked European leaders over the coals in a speech at the Munich Security Conference. He did this because Europe is no longer protecting its self-stated democratic values. And the German leaders listening almost choked on their strudel. Vance referred to a threat from within and called upon them to return to, quote-unquote, the extraordinary blessings of liberty. Here are a few of his words. The threat that I worry the most about is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. What I worry about is the threat from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values, values shared with the United States of America. He then went on and challenged them for their increasing trends toward the censoring of free speech, basically thought police, like predicted in 1984. He said, you cannot win a democratic mandate by censoring your opponents or putting them in jail. Now, that was a reference to what Democrats tried to do to Trump. But he was also talking about European governments encouraging people to report fellow citizens guilty of thought crimes. Free speech, I fear, is in retreat, says Vance. Well, my friends, it's more than fear. It's happening. Ask Adam Smith Connor, a citizen of Great Britain, not so Great Britain anymore. He was praying outside an abortion clinic. Now, the good news is that the police did not walk up and automatically arrest him for praying. They were courteous enough to ask him what he was praying about, as if it was any of their business. When he said he was praying against abortion, not doing anything violent, praying against abortion, they arrested him for that. Boy, that makes thought police less hyperbole and more literal. They were literally asking him for the train of thought going on in his head because he was praying silently. They couldn't hear his words. They demanded to know what words were in his head, and he was arrested. Well, so much for merry old England. But it happens in other countries too. In Germany, you can be arrested for publicly insulting a politician. On the CBS show Face the Nation, the host Brennan questioned Secretary of State Marco Rubio about Vance's comments. Here were her words. He was standing in a country where free speech was weaponized to conduct a genocide. Okay, the country he was standing in was Germany. The genocide she's referring to was the Holocaust. Are you catching this, my friends? She's talking about Germany and its history of Nazism. She's claiming that the Holocaust was caused by freedom of speech. Yes, you heard it correctly. The Holocaust caused by freedom of speech. I thought I'd heard everything, but just when you think things couldn't get stupider, somebody takes the cake. This is, without a doubt, the most moronic comment I have ever witnessed from the mainstream media. Now, what she was trying to say was that hate speech against the Jews brought Hitler into power. Well, yeah, people will listen to hateful words and idiotic words, and they'll act on them. That's why we need to keep other words free to challenge them. For example, I just told you that in Germany today, you're not allowed to criticize their leaders. Well, you weren't allowed to criticize Hitler either. The Nazis did a lot more than talk to come into power. Yeah, they used talk, but they also used violence, they used arson, they used threats, and as they gained power and came into power, the first thing to go was freedom of speech. It was against the law to even make jokes about Hitler. It is not free speech that will lead us to the next Holocaust. It is the suppression of free speech that will lead us to the next Holocaust. Make no mistake. And while we're on the subject, here's another thing that can bring about totalitarianism. Our republic turning into an oligarchy. Now, I know everybody calls Elon Musk an oligarch. I'm not talking about Musk. Musk was appointed by a duly elected president who promised the kinds of things Musk was doing. Those that voted Trump see democracy in action, but the democracy is being overturned by the courts. And that's what I'm calling oligarchy. The courts. Or at least the way the courts have gained power over the years. President Trump is being sued left and right. Well, left mostly, from the left. For example, one of President Trump's executive orders says that transgenders cannot serve in the military. He's been challenged. This is going to court. All this order did was overturn a different order by Joe Biden. Doesn't matter. It's going to be settled by the courts. Here are a few words from Trump's executive order. The United States military has a clear mission to protect the American people and our homeland as the world's most lethal and effective fighting force. Success in this existential mission requires a singular focus on developing the requisite warrior ethos, and the pursuit of military excellence cannot be diluted to accommodate political agendas or other ideologies harmful to unit cohesion. Recently, however, the armed forces have been afflicted with radical gender ideology to appease activists unconcerned with the requirements of military service like physical and mental health, selfishness, and unit cohesion. Long-standing Department of Defense policy provides that it is the policy of the DoD to ensure that service members are free of medical conditions or physical defects that may reasonably be expected to require excessive time lost from duty for necessary treatment or hospitalization. As a result, many mental and physical health conditions are incompatible with active duty from conditions that require substantial medication or other medical treatment to bipolar and related disorders, eating disorders, suicidality, and prior psychiatric hospitalization. All right, those were the words of President Trump's executive order. Now, I want you to imagine that the political climate is different. I want you to imagine that you heard those words, but you didn't know they were coming from Donald Trump. And I want you to imagine that LGBTQ is not the most powerful, feared lobby in the country, one that politicians and city councils and companies and schools roll over and play dead for. And ask yourself what it is about these words exactly that do not make perfect sense where the military is involved. Try it. It's impossible. You can't answer that question about what doesn't make sense, because all of it does make sense. You know it, I know it, everybody knows it. But we're living in the age of the emperor's new clothes. Hey, that may look like a man, but it's really a woman, and intelligent people would know that. Why do we know that it's really a woman? Because he identifies as a woman, silly. My friends, many of my fellow conservatives are sure this nonsense will get straightened out favorably by the Supreme Court. We may get dumb lower rulings, but it's going to the Supreme Court. Well, I hope they're right. I'm not so sure. Yes, SCOTUS has made some good rulings because of the conservative majority, but not always. It's often a coin toss predicting what they'll do. I'm not confident the Supreme Court will have the courage and backbone to stand up to the LGBTQ movement. Don't forget they overturned DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. This law, national law, federal law, was passed by the House, passed by the Senate, signed into law by the president. And the court overturns it. Two branches of government together passed it. It's overturned by one branch. And of course, in overturning DOMA, the federal law, they were automatically by osmosis overturning some of the state laws passed, such as Proposition 8 in California and lower state rulings. My friends, this should not be. The Constitution does not give the Supreme Court this authority. Let me say that again. The Constitution does not give the Supreme Court this authority. But because of a very early case in our history, Marbury versus Madison, a precedent developed. And in the passage of time, Congress made this worse by passing laws about judicial review for lower federal courts. This, too, was unconstitutional, but Congress did it. Congress established judicial review. They didn't have to. They shouldn't have. They can rescind it any time. But if they do, guess what will happen? The law will be overturned by judicial review. Just wait. Can you picture it now? A headline from the future. Supreme Court declares the Constitution to be unconstitutional. Or how about this one? Supreme Court overturns God's recent answer to prayer. Says God did not have standing. Okay, so I'm speaking tongue-in-cheek, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
It should be obvious when or when not a law violates our Constitution. The Supreme Court for many years has ruled as if it was rolling the dice. We should not have to be waiting with bated breath every time they deliver decisions from the bench. Sometimes hearing a decision we like, sometimes hearing a decision that sets our freedoms back 100 years. The real problem is that the Supreme Court should never have been given this much power in the first place. Yes, sometimes it's benevolent. But what about the times it's unconstitutional and dictatorial? What about the times they rule in ways that cannot possibly be justified by the Constitution, even though they claim it's in there somewhere? To anyone who thinks the Supreme Court has a perfect, exclusively authoritative, unchecked understanding of our Constitution, I have just three words for you. Dred Scott decision, where the wise, insightful, legal scholars ruled that African American slaves were property. Still care to point to that court as a superior, unquestioned power? Newsflash. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Nowhere. Don't bother looking. You won't find it. The purpose of the Supreme Court is not to interpret the Constitution. The purpose of the Supreme Court is to enforce the Constitution by being the highest court in the land when people can't settle disputes in lower courts. In all likelihood, many listeners right now are raising their eyebrows, even fellow conservatives, who sympathize with public reaction against judicial activism. Perhaps what I'm saying sounds too good to be true or too bizarre to be true. Certainly this position is out of the mainstream at our present time in history. If you asked most Americans, they would say it is indeed the job of the Supreme Court to interpret our founding document. So would most lawyers and certainly a good many judges. Yet some legal scholars would agree with me. Others might answer delicately, as law professor and talk show host Hugh Hewitt did when I interviewed him on my own radio show a number of years ago, asked if the Constitution never intended for the Supreme Court to interpret. He answered, "It can be so argued." Throughout history, majority opinion has often been wrong. Most people of the world accepted slavery for the greater balance of history, including, once again, the Supreme Court itself, but I won't belabor that point. And so, perhaps we would be well served to temporarily ignore public opinion and instead examine the testimony of facts from the past. The interpretation tradition in our country began when Thomas Jefferson refused to install some justices John Adams had appointed before he left office. Since the judges were never inaugurated, Jefferson didn't feel obligated to use them. His government was sued in a landmark case called Marbury versus Madison, 1803. Because this unusual situation had never come up in such a high-level, complicated scenario, litigation turned to the Supreme Court, which ordered Jefferson, via his Secretary of State, James Madison, to appear before them and explain himself. Now, I love this. Jefferson ignored them. Marbury, one of the justices spurned by Jefferson, referred to the Judiciary Act of 1789 as a basis for the court being able to issue such commands. Ironically, the court, after first showing sympathy to Marbury, pronounced a contradictory ruling. It decided that the Judiciary Act was unconstitutional because it gave the Supreme Court more power than the Constitution intended. So, even though the justices were sympathetic to Marbury and insisted the law set up by Congress was on his side, they ultimately ruled against him by deeming that same act of Congress to be technically unconstitutional. Marbury, according to the high justices, should have started with a lower court rather than the ultimate court in the land, and therefore they could not issue the verdict that both they and he wanted. This decision was actually a political stroke of genius under the leadership of Chief Justice John Marshall, who found a way to lecture and chastise his rival Jefferson without giving the popular president an actual court order that he would certainly refuse to obey. In short, Marshall devised a clever strategy to save face by having his cake and eating it too. Nevertheless, in calling an act of Congress unconstitutional for giving too much power to the court, this landmark ruling established a tradition about the Supreme Court telling us what the Constitution intended. Gotta see the irony. Now, here's the thing. Jefferson disagreed with the court's newfound powers, even though in this particular instance, the ruling was personally convenient, as now he did not have to appoint the justices. Jefferson feared that if this understanding of judicial power were accepted, it would be placing us under the despotism of an oligarchy. His words. Unfortunately, 1803, a year so early in the history of our republic, spawned a custom that we never quite shook. I am convinced this is based upon a mistake grandfather clause into a tradition that has taken on a life of its own. Today, we live in the debris of that fateful Marbury versus Madison ruling. Not only the Supreme Court, but other courts along the ladder make decisions to overturn the will of the people or the laws of Congress. A fair example from a few years ago is one of the most chilling of all. At first, the people of California passed a law stating that marriage would be defined as a union between a man and a woman. Then a court overturned the law, claiming it was unconstitutional. So later on, in 2008, after some 7 million people passed Proposition 8, the California Constitution was actually changed. I went on the radio at this point predicting that somebody would find the amended Constitution unconstitutional. I said it in a way that sounded sarcastic and tongue-in-cheek, but I was also dead serious. Well, that is just exactly what happened. A federal judge declared the California Constitution to be unconstitutional, that is, in serious conflict with the federal Constitution, which, incidentally, says that our independent states have a right to make their own constitutions. The judge's rationale is that the state constitution violates federal rights, which must transcend all states and be true for all Americans, namely the promise for equal protection under the law. Other such rulings were also made, and the Supreme Court upheld these brilliant reasonings. Meanwhile, the will of some 7 million Californians and millions from other states with similar cases going on making its way up to the Supreme Court had been traded in for the opinion of a few judges. Now, I don't mean any disrespect for the honorable profession of magistrates. The Supreme Court is our third branch of government with an important role to play. When unusual situations arise, it falls upon the courts to apply our Constitution. I suspect that's what many people mean anyway when they use the word interpret, but it is a false idea that judges can legislate from the bench with unchecked power over the other two branches of government, free to overturn laws at will. Such usurping of authority was the farthest thing from the minds of our forefathers. The Constitution is a clearly written document. It had to be. The authors knew a whole country would be governed by it. They did not wish to confuse us. They did not write in riddles or parables. Neither is it poetry or symbolism. If we know how to read, we do not need anyone to tell us what it means. With all due homage to those who graduated law school, I have a message for everyone else. You do not have to be a lawyer to comprehend the Constitution. Most people will challenge you for having such brass, but Thomas Jefferson will be on record agreeing with you. You're not in bad company. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480539, W&S Electric.
Looking for a book you won't be able to put down? Push the Winds Around is a romance set in the context of science fiction. Dr. Brandon Krieger is given the opportunity of a lifetime, a psychologist's dream. Through the usage of his physics professor friend's time machine, Brandon travels 20 years back through time in an attempt to change one man's destiny. Tom Kyle, a convicted and unremorseful murderer, is located in the past when he was a 6-year-old boy. Brandon's mission? to alter Tom Kyle's path and prevent him from being a vicious killer. Matters are complicated when Brandon finds himself falling in love with young Tom's mother. Push the Winds Around, a novel by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Say hello again to my producer, Brendan Thomas.
Well, 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 Bob, how are you doing tonight?
Doing good. How about yourself?
Very, very good. So I wanted to respond to a couple of your monologues here that you played prior. So we talked about Doge for a very quick second in the first part of the monologue. Do you think those stimulus checks are going to be coming to us here soon, or probably not, and probably not as high as Elon Musk is promising?
It's hard to say. You know, Trump and Musk, they love to just throw a lot of stuff out there, mostly Trump. I don't have a problem with it in theory, because it is a list, a gargantuan list of money that our tax dollars have gone to.
Right.
That's so totally wasted.
I mean, 200-year-old Social Security checks that keep going through, that is ridiculous.
I love this. I'd like to meet this guy. Boy, right.
I'm telling you what. But anyway, so your opinion is...
Well, I think that in theory it sounds good, because boy, it is our money and they should give it back. Personally, I'd rather see them pay down the deficit, because if they don't pay down the deficit, we're not going to have a country left.
That's
so
true.
If they send me a check, I'll take it.
Yes, well, I will too. Yes, any day of the
week. I may be thoughtful, but I'm not stupid.
So one of the other things I wanted to mention was, you know, Marbury versus Madison wasn't the first court case to establish like judicial review.
Well, in other countries, they had had it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I'm talking about here in America too. You can talk about Hilton versus United States, which happened in 1796. That was an early court case where the court held that a yearly tax on carriages did not violate Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, or Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4 requirements for the appointing of direct taxes. This was argued against by Alexander Hamilton at the time. So.
Yeah, I heard of that one. My understanding was that somehow Marbury cemented it more in people's minds than that one did.
Absolutely,
that one
yeah.
It was a more direct quote from the actual
Supreme.
Where they actually in their ruling said that they had that power.
Exactly.
And I really like the integrity of Thomas Jefferson, because the court ruled with him, and yet he still had the integrity to say it's a dangerous ruling to give the court that much
this
power.
This is my one flaw of the whole checks and balances system. It's the fact that they weren't specific enough when it comes to this checks and balances system our founding fathers started up. Thus, the judicial branch just automatically had all this power, apparently, they thought they could have. And it's ridiculous to see where it is now.
Well, I think the idea was, well, there were two things. They were meant to be completely separate, and they were meant to just be the highest court in the land. Like, if people had disputes, they didn't like the way one court settled it, they could keep appealing, and the Supreme Court would be where it stopped. Mm-hmm. But also, there's the idea of the enforcing of the Constitution. Now, obviously, the executive branch does that too, but if a politician was violating the law or breaking the law, there had to be some way to get around it. But it's got to be really obvious in the Constitution. So I don't have a problem with the Supreme Court enforcing it, but when they come along and say, hey, you passed a rule and we find that it's unconstitutional, and maybe you don't see it, but we do by our experience, that's...
Right, but they have the most power because they can overrule certain laws.
Exactly. Take a look at DOMA, which was one of the examples I gave. Yes. Under Bill Clinton, even. I don't think Clinton would have the same sentiments today, but the Congress passed the law, the executive branch signed the law, and then the court just overturns it. That was never the intention of our
father. Right, right. And they did it so quickly, too, at that time, because they really didn't like that law at that time. So
right.
The other thing I wanted to point out was the approval rating of the Supreme Court. I don't know if you've noticed. The one I'm looking at is the Gallup polls. Back in 2000, we had an approval rating of 62%. Right now, in 2024, it's at 44%. And then the disapproval rating versus 2000, it was just 29%. And now it's at 51% of a disapproval. of a
well,
rating.
Well, that's
right
because
now.
The Democrats have succeeded in painting the conservative judges as activists when actually the conservative justices, at least in the way they were talking at their confirmation hearings, mm-hmm. just believed in getting back to the original intent of the forefathers. So the Democrats are just great at accusing the opposite side of what they, in fact, are actually doing. When they talk about stacking the courts, mm-hmm. wanting to put term limits on the courts, when people say, well, the justices should just be completely unbiased, who are we kidding? You can tell by the kinds of questions they're asking at the hearings, they're these litmus tests. So yeah, they've succeeded in painting the conservative court. Now, like I said, my problem with the conservative court is I don't think they always vote conservative
right.
enough, or I shouldn't even say conservative. I don't think they always vote according to original intent. I've been very disappointed with Amy Coney Barrett, for example, and mm-hmm. who knows what they'll do with some of this stuff that Trump's going up. I think we're going to see them rule with Trump with some, not rule with Trump with others. But again, having said that, that's the problem. The liberals have succeeded in painting any conservative justice mm-hmm. as being by. They were even saying that Amy Barrett should recuse herself from certain cases because she's Catholic and her morality will affect your case. Did they ask Sonia Sotomayor to recuse herself when they were overturning DOMA?
Right,
of
exactly.
course
no,
not.
No. I would actually kind of argue that it goes on both ends of the spectrum, to be honest, because I actually think that the more that media gets into your personal life, the more it comes out about this. I mean,
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Ginsburg, thank you. Yeah. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. When she passed away, all of a sudden, all this personal information of what made her look good at first now started to go the other limelight of the way all of a sudden. So I think it actually goes on both ends here, especially with media and how they're able to get all this information now about your political background or your personal background, and they're able to find more
well,
stuff about
they are
you.
Human beings, and their biases are going to come in, but that's the problem. That's why they just shouldn't be given that much power.
It's true. It's true. So very quickly, I wanted to talk about, super quick, the Pope is currently in critical condition right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, and the way they're talking, it sounds like they're not really expecting him to make it.
Right. So now, when they do a new selection of the Pope, if this does happen across, is this by a vote, or is this by the next person in line from what
Oh,
else?
No. My understanding is the Cardinals vote, and it has okay. to be somebody who's already a Cardinal. My limited understanding,
yes.
I should say, but the Cardinals will vote on that.
Okay. And that's within the Vatican City itself, or is that also international? They'll look at all the
I don't think the Cardinal has to actually live in the Vatican.
Oh, he does
City.
Not.
I
okay.
don't believe so, but don't quote me.
Okay,
on that.
I won't.
We probably need an actual Catholic scholar.
There. I will go ahead and look up that information later on. The last story I wanted to talk about. So as we probably have heard the news recently, Donald Trump and all the FCC as well has been really clunking down on NPR and PBS stations.
Because our tax dollars are paying for it.
Yes, but they were specifically looking at the fact that they're commercializing themselves. And due to FCC regulations, they cannot be doing that. They have to be underwritten or by donations. So that was the big thing in that news. And now all of a sudden this pops up. Cincinnati Public Radio has now officially opened a $32 million headquarter for their new radio studios. So where's that $32 million coming from? Because I thought NPR was struggling is what I was understanding with funding, and not only from...
You mean under what pseudonym did George Soros fund them? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, I should have realized that, right?
I mean, I don't know.
No,
but I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
But one of the things that, in order to cut off mainstream media, is Trump has really X'd off the budget for how the Corporation of Public Broadcasting gets every single year. He's continuously cut those funds off. So NPR gets a little bit of funding from that. But if Trump is cutting funding from the Corporate Broadcasting Corporation, I'm trying to figure out where else could it come from again. Because, like you said, it could be coming from some big name scholar, or I shouldn't say scholars, but some big names in media.
Yeah, well, what happens is Congress appropriates money. They give them to these agencies. They don't pay much attention to how the agencies are spending. And then these agencies can also, in turn, start giving money to nonprofit corporations, or I guess even profit corporations that pop up. So it just becomes a monster that takes on a life
it's
of
true.
Its own. And that's the problem. We just don't know how all this money is metastasizing. And that's why I think it's great that he's putting Elon Musk on the loose here.
Exactly. And I would also suggest that Congress really should be doing its research, just not by looking by a name. Oh, it says National Public Radio. That must be a good thing for everybody. Well, look behind the information. What's NPR providing for everybody besides biased information with their news sources and things of that nature? So that's another thing that Congress should be doing. So we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then it's everyone's favorite segment of the Bob Siegel Show besides Stump Jim Barrier. We got some Bible questions
oh,
for you.
Oh, Stump Bob with the Bible instead.
That's right.
Right. This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture, and always here with some great Bible questions when we're discussing Christianity, my producer, Brendan Thomas.
Yes, I believe this is your wife's favorite segment, to be honest, actually, too.
Anything that's not politics is my wife's favorite, right. But that's true. The third thing that we do a lot is movie and book reviews.
Yeah.
She'd put the Bible over that, as well any of us should.
That's true. So I wanted to ask about Revelation chapter 11, verse 3. It says, I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. Verses 4 through 12 describe the other things the individuals will do for God during tribulation. But my main focus is, who are these two witnesses described here? Because I saw three different takes, and I wanted to see which one you thought
right.
It could be.
Well, of course, again, and we've talked about Revelation before on the air, it's got so much symbolism that we have to start by saying we don't know. Mm-hmm. And there are guesses. Now, one very popular guess is that it's Moses and Elijah.
That was one of my guesses as well.
Moses died, and so for it to be Moses, he would have had to resurrect. But then that gets a little bit dicey, because once you're resurrected, you're immortal, and yet this person is getting killed. There are some Jewish legends, because the Bible does say that God came down and personally buried Moses. There are some Jewish legends. They're not mainstream Jewish legends, but it's a few that maybe Moses didn't experience death. Now, Elijah got caught up into heaven, too, without passing away. But those are two of the candidates for a couple of reasons. One, when Jesus goes up to the Mount of Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah are with him, and Peter and James and John see them. How they were identified as those two, obviously Jesus was chatting with them. They finally figured out who they were. So there's precedent for those two in the past. Also, these guys are doing the kinds of things that Moses and Elijah did.
I was about to say that.
They're talking about turning the water into blood, which Moses did, and they're talking about stopping the rain, which Elijah did. Now, for myself, I'm mentioning that's a popular opinion. I'm inclined to think that it may be a couple of people like Moses and Elijah, like an Elijah the Second. Actually, John the Baptist was already considered an Elijah the Second by Jesus, so this would be an Elijah the Third. I would be more inclined to think two people in the tradition. There's another view, because of the symbolism of Revelation, that these are not necessarily two men, but they're talking about the entire church, or at least anybody in the church that did not give into the Antichrist, because these people are doing this during the 3.5 years of the tribulation, during half of the tribulation, and they are disobeying the Antichrist, they're finally getting murdered, and then they resurrect, and it could be a symbolic precursor to what they give as a more detailed account at the end of the book of Revelation, where people rise from the dead, and they say these resurrected beings are the souls of those who were beheaded by the Antichrist who did not succumb to him. So that's another possibility, that this could just be the rapture of the church and our resurrection. It could be more than two people. But if they are two people, they're are certainly two people like Moses and Elijah. Could they possibly be Moses and Elijah? Yes, but how they were resurrected beings and became immortal, and then God says, well, you're going to experience mortality again. Is that possible? Well, yeah, Jesus was the second person of the Trinity.
It's true, yes.
He took on mortality, so anything's possible.
Okay.
But there's a wide range of other guesses, too. I gave you some of the more common ones.
Right. So one of the ones I wanted to mention, too, was, I'm going to mispronounce him probably, Enoch or Enoch?
Enoch.
Enoch, yes. Yeah. That was another popular
he
one.
He was another, because Enoch and Elijah were two people that got raptured ahead of time. They went up into heaven without ever experiencing death. So Enoch is another one. Now, we know very little about the life of Enoch. But yeah, he is another candidate for that, certainly.
And then the other one I wanted to point out was Zechariah chapter 4 is kind of interesting because it kind of coincides with this verse for some reason. Specifically, Zechariah has a vision in which he sees a solid gold lampstand, and on top is a bowl of oil and an olive tree that stands on each side. So the lampstand gives its light without human maintenance, being constantly supplied by the olive oil flowing from the trees of the bowl. God's message to Zechariah was that God's work would be accomplished not by might nor by power, but my spirit. So Zechariah asks the meaning of the olive trees and the branches. These are the two anointed ones who stand by the Lord of the whole earth. This is like kind of coinciding with your...
Yeah, that would certainly support the theory of them being two actual human beings, literal human beings, prophets. And I'm glad you brought that up because there are books in the Old Testament, prophetic books, that Revelation was written in the tradition of. Certainly Zechariah is one of them. Zechariah keys in quite a bit on the coming of the Messiah, which we say second coming as Christians. To the Jews, it was all supposed to be one coming.
Mm-hmm.
That was their understanding. Ezekiel would be another one, and certainly Daniel has all kinds of shared imagery with Revelation. Daniel's sometimes known as a companion to the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm. But the main thing I want to point out is that let's not argue as Christians as who these two individuals are. No matter what, the point is...
God's going to send somebody.
Yes, he will. Yes,
whether
exactly.
It's two, whether it's a multi... there are going to be people that stand up to the Antichrist and are willing to give their lives for Christ.
Exactly.
That's the important
thing. Exactly. Yeah. So we're going to go to commercial break. And after this, we are going to be talking about Jesus healing. Is it two blind men or one blind man?
Okay.
Who knows?
Yes. So. All right.
Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? Why does the Bible call premarital sex a sin? How will God judge the people who never heard of Jesus? These are but some of the critical concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob Siegel tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book will be enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
I'm Dr. David Poole, president of San Diego Christian College. If you've been thinking about getting your pilot's license and a degree in aviation, come fly with us. We have a long history of producing aviation leaders. Whether your focus is on commercial, missionary, or military, we're ready to help you achieve your goals from a Christian worldview. So look us up at sdcc.edu. That's sdcc.edu. San Diego Christian College. Come fly with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Say hello again to Brendan Thomas.
Well, with another Bible question comes another question of, is the Bible being inaccurate? That's my lead up to this. So I wanted to talk about Matthew chapter 20, verses 29 through 34. As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet, but they shouted all the louder, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." Jesus stopped and called them. "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. "Lord," they answered, "we want our sight." Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. Immediately they received their sight and followed them. So that's two blind men. However, Mark chapter 10, verses 46 through 52 says, "Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus," which is the son of Timaeus, "was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, 'Jesus, Son of God, have mercy on me.' And then many rebuked him, and he was told to be quiet, but then he shouted it again. Jesus then said, 'Call him.' So they called the blind man, 'Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you.' Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. 'What do you want me to do for you?' Jesus asked him. The blind man said, 'Rabbi, I want to see.' 'Go,' said Jesus, 'your faith has healed you.' Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road." So the main question comes down to, did he heal one blind man or two blind men in this story?
Okay, now this is not the only place where we have these kinds of so-called, I'll emphasize the word so-called, discrepancies in the scripture. Mm-hmm. Similar with the resurrection accounts. The women go to the tomb, and in one account there's one angel, and in another account there's two angels. Mm-hmm. This is because when people are reporting things, people will remember different details or emphasize different details. It's like a traffic accident. You're going through the day and a friend of yours comes up and says, "Did you hear that Fred and Sue were in a car accident?" And you're like, "Oh no, I didn't hear. Are they okay?" "Oh yeah, they're fine. They're fine." And then later on someone says, "Did you hear that Fred and Sue and John were in a car accident?" And you go, "Whoa, okay, I heard about Fred and Sue, but you're telling me John was in the car too?" This happens, and we accept this all the time. Now, when mm-hmm. we're talking about the Bible, people go, "Oh, well, if it's the word of God, it should be word for word the same." Let me tell you exactly what Bible skeptics would do if the four Gospels were word for word the same.
Yes.
They would say, "Well, these four Gospels claim to be written by four different people, but obviously they were all written by one person and he just wrote four different names on it." Even though it might make us uncomfortable when the details don't seem to 100% mesh, historically, this is considered really good news, because what it does is it proves from the onset that these are different eyewitness accounts.
Absolutely.
Now, having said that, in the account with Mark, I think it's interesting that the guy is named Bartimaeus and his father Timaeus. Mm-hmm. That included the Greek word for honor. This was obviously the son of an official, which may account for why this guy would be more remembered. It would have been a bigger event, like, "Oh, Bartimaeus was healed. Bartimaeus was healed." Mm-hmm. "Well, I heard there was another guy there too." "Well, yeah, there was. But Bartimaeus," I think that's what's going on here.
Okay.
Now, I don't know that that would satisfy some diehard Bible skeptic that's looking for things. But again, I have grown to appreciate the fact that things are given to us. I wouldn't call them contradictions, but varying details.
Yes. Another thing I wanted to point out was, at that time, technically there were two Jerichos at the time as well.
Yes, so, there was an old Jericho that they passed through, and then there was another Jericho. And it has also been suggested by some that in one place Jesus healed two blind men, and that in another place he healed one blind man.
That's why I was going to say,
he did so many multiple healings. That's certainly possible.
Okay.
As well. We know that he fed 5,000 and then also fed 4,000. And whereas it might be easy to say, well, one gospel writer just got the numbers wrong, the problem is both the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000 are found in the Gospel of Matthew, same author. So he's very aware that it happened twice.
Mm-hmm. I would also like to point out too that I noticed that Luke chapter 18, verses 35 through 43 also state that it was just one man as well too. But I know it's not that important too in terms of the context, because again, what you just said could validate everything.
It could have been a different Jericho, but it could vary. very easily have been that Jesus healed two people and one of them was better known.
Mm-hmm. And again, where was Jesus going? Was he entering into old Jericho and going to new Jericho or vice versa?
And but it's again, worded similar. One says he's approaching Jericho. The other one says he's leaving Jericho. I'm glad you did that research because there were two different Jerichos. There was an old one and a newer rebuilt one.
Yeah. The newer rebuilt Jericho still stands, I'm assuming, compared to the old Jericho, I'm assuming.
In the way it did back
no,
in
no,
those,
of course, of course
in those
not.
Days.
No.
I believe that it's mostly in ruins today.
Oh, okay. But, gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Well, I wanted to visit it because I wanted to see the spot where he healed him. That would have been awesome. But, oh, well, maybe next time. Well, Bob, thank you again for this wonderful evening.
Brandon, my pleasure.
It's always great to hear some like new takes on the Bible and better understand it, too.
Absolutely.
So thank you again for that.
All right.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.